This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Days into the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, and the death toll has surpassed 27,200, mostly women and children. Damascus says U.S. strikes on areas where Syrian forces are fighting Daesh remnants once again prove Washington's collusion with terrorists. And tens of thousands of people march in the U.K.'s capital, London, towards their support for Palestinians facing Israeli aggression. Thank you for joining us. Now, intense Israeli attacks on Gaza have been continuing for 4 months now. In the latest spate of attacks, at least 100 people were killed across the besieged Palestinian territory. There were fresh air and artillery attacks around Khan Yunis. That's Gaza's main southern city, which has been recently the focal point of Israeli strikes. Medical facilities in Khan Yunis have been affected as well. Al Amal and Al Nasser hospitals have been under an Israeli siege for more than a week. Now, the United Nations is warning of a serious shortage of oxygen supplies at the two medical centers. After Khan Yunis, the city of Rafah will be the next target of the Israeli ground attacks. That's according to the regime's military. Rafah is located in southern Gaza and hosts hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians. UN agencies have been warning about the deteriorating situation in Rafah.
So I want to emphasize our deep concern about the escalation of hostilities in Khan Yunis, which has resulted in an increase in the number of internally displaced people seeking refuge in Rafah. In recent days, thousands of Palestinians have continued to flee to the south, which is already hosting over half the Gaza's population, of some 2.3 million people. Most are living in makeshift structures, tents, or out in the open. Rafah is a pressure cooker of despair, and we fear for what comes next.
The spokesman for the UN Humanitarian Office also warned about disease outbreaks in Gaza. He added that there is simply not enough food, not enough clean drinking water, and no protection. The World Health Organization says people in Gaza are enduring unimaginable circumstances. They are exhausted, hungry, and traumatized. And UNICEF says at least 17,000 children in the Gaza Strip are accompanied, unaccompanied, or separated from their family. It says Palestinian children's mental health is severely impacted and almost all of them are in need of support. Over 27,200 people have been killed in Gaza since October 7. Some 12,500 of them are children. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier from Gaza with more details on the intensified Israeli attacks on residential buildings. Let's take a listen.
More intense Israeli fire belts hitting and targeting the residential areas in Khan Yunis city. Over the last couple of hours, several residential houses were targeted by the Israeli continuous airstrikes, leaving dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings and houses destroyed and demolished to the ground. Those continuous and constant airstrikes waged by the Israeli warplanes actually left five Palestinian civilians. They were brought to the European hospital as the Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis city are still out of service over the continuous Israeli siege imposed on both hospitals. So we are talking about continuous Israeli strikes hitting Khan Yunis city, leaving more casualties among the Palestinian civilians. In addition to that, when it comes to Rafah city, more residential apartments actually actually were attacked and targeted by the Israeli warplanes, leaving more casualties among the Palestinian civilians, raising the concerns among the Palestinian civilians, particularly those who fled to Rafah City, that the Israeli occupation forces would intensify their attacks on the city, which means more catastrophic situation and more massacres yet to be committed in that city. In Gaza City, as we speak right now, several Palestinian houses were destroyed after the Israeli warplanes attacked them and leveled them to the ground, leaving at least 9 Palestinian civilians killed. In the northern part of Gaza City, particularly Beit Lahia City, the Israeli occupation forces carried out several airstrikes targeting the residential areas, particularly the surrounding areas of Sheikh Zayed residential towers, which are located in Beit Lahia City, leaving more Palestinian casualties as well. In the meantime, the Palestinian resistance factions on the ground repeatedly announced that they are fighting back against the Israeli tanks managed or attempted to raid the center and the depth of those cities. Al-Qassam Brigades announced that they have hit several Israeli tanks on the ground, while Saraya al-Quds announced that they have launched several mortar projectiles into the Israeli forces mobilized in the center of Gaza City, particularly the University Square.
Now it's time for the news review section, where we talk in depth on the day's top story. The U.S. says it has carried out airstrikes on 85 targets inside Iraq and Syria. That's after Washington pledged to respond to a deadly drone strike on its troops in Jordan. Iraqi government says at least 16 people were killed in U.S. strikes in the country. Civilians were amongst those killed, and 36 more people were wounded in the bombings that targeted both civilian and security areas. U.S. Central Command claims the targets include rocket, missile, and drone depots. The U.S. president says the strikes will continue at times and places of Washington's choosing. However, Joe Biden says the U.S. does not see conflict in West Asia. Washington has confirmed the deaths of 3 of his forces in a drone strike that hit his military base last weekend. It marked the first time U.S. military personnel died in an attack since the start of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza on October the 7th. Now, strong reactions to the U.S. attacks are streaming in from regional countries, not least by Iraq and Syria themselves. Iraq condemned the strikes as a violation of its sovereignty. It warned that the attack will have disastrous consequences for the region. Iraq's foreign ministry says it has called in the U.S. charge d'affaires in Baghdad to deliver an official protest. Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces said the U.S. attacks is a violation of the country's sovereignty and a blatant disregard for international laws. Syria, meanwhile, said the aggression caused casualties among civilians and soldiers and inflicted heavy material damage on the eastern part of the country. It added that this is the same region where Syrian forces are battling the remnants of the Daesh Takfiri group, and this proves U.S. collusion with the terrorists. Iran says the strikes are another strategic mistake by the U.S. or threat only serves Israeli interests. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also condemned the strikes, saying Washington has poured oil on the fire in the region. Yemen's Ansarullah movement stamped the U.S. strikes as flagrant violation of sovereignty of Iraq and Syria. The movement said the U.S. aggression against those countries proved its firm support for Israel's crimes in Gaza. Russia says the U.S. is sowing chaos and destruction in the Middle East. It has also called for a Security Council meeting. Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Rick Sterling, investigative journalist from Walnut Creek, California, and also Daniel Shaw, professor of race, ethnicity, class, and gender from New York. Gentlemen, welcome. Now, Mr. Sterling, beginning with you, let's begin with your initial thoughts on the situation right now. The U.S. has finally responded by not stopping the genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza, but by attacking the countries which are trying to stop the almost 4 months of onslaught on the people of Gaza. So what could we expect in the coming days? What could we expect from the Iraqi and Syrian governments and also the resistance groups in those countries?
Well, I certainly hope that the United Nations Security Council takes up the issue as Russia has requested. It's absolutely necessary because we're on a slippery slope here. A friend of mine who lives 125 miles north of San Francisco is reporting that there are military jets constantly flying overhead all day long, training and in preparation for what we don't know. Meanwhile, at another military Air Force base just outside of the San Francisco area, activists are planning to try to blockade that on Tuesday morning, and they're drawing attention to the fact that weapons from the United States going to Israel to continue the slaughter are being shipped out of Travis Air Force Base. So the Syrian and Iraqi governments, of course, are completely within their rights to be demanding that that this stop the aggression from the United States. I note that it's just 8 or 9 days ago that there was talk of the United States withdrawing their bases from Syria and Iraq. That was very welcome news. And then Victoria Nuland got into the act some days later, saying that the U.S. would absolutely not be withdrawing from the bases. The crux of the matter is that the neocons running U.S. foreign policy do not want peace, and they are constantly promoting expansion and war.
That's right, Mr. Sterling. Mr. Shaw, can the U.S. afford another full-fledged war, which is, again, like Mr. Sterling said, against their own people's liking, and at a time where they could use the billions of dollars of funding to Israel, and not forgetting Ukraine as well, while the money we're talking about, hundreds of billions of dollars, could be used to remedy its own ailing economy or to be used for humanitarian causes, not killing women and children?
That is the sentiment across the United States, especially among young people. Joe Biden's popularity among youthful voters is at an all-time low. The people of this country continue to march for peace, to march against the genocide. And we've been asking now for a week, if we look at the picture of these three young U.S. soldiers slash mercenaries, really are used and manipulated as mercenaries. They're so youthful. They come from an oppressed background. They didn't deserve to die for empire. It's extremely sickening how many of our young people from black and brown and poor white backgrounds have to join the U.S. military just so they can try to get a scholarship or feed their families. It's akin to the conscription or the economic draft and the actual de jure draft that existed in the 1960s and 70s and the horrific war of aggression against the Vietnamese people. And as Rick Sterling has pointed out, the Syrians, the Iraqis, this is a united Middle East that is saying they want the U.S. occupiers and the Israeli genocidaires out of their countries. We're seeing a pan-Arab unity, a pan-Muslim, a pan-Middle East unity that perhaps we haven't seen in many years. Palestine continues to be a lightning rod for anti-Zionist and anti-imperialist sentiments across the region.
That's right. Mr. Sterling, Mr. Shaw, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
There you have it, Mr. Rick Sterling, investigative journalist from Walnut Creek, and also Mr. Daniel Shaw, professor of race, ethnicity, and class and gender. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of the News Review program. Thank you for being with us. In Britain, hundreds of thousands have once again marched through the centre of London against the US-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza. Protesters slammed the UK's complicity in that genocide and voiced support for the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation. Saipul Reza has sent us this report.
The UK's first national demo since the International Court of Justice ruling on the Israeli regime's genocidal war on Gaza was another enormous gathering. People came from all over the UK. The sentiment here, very clearly, ceasefire now.
And I, for one, will not sit at home and watch this genocide played out on television. They said never again in 1948, but it is happening again, and it's a Holocaust against the Gazans.
As with all the previous ones, this too was a broad spectrum of anti-war, pro-Palestinian sentiment, all here to push the government to act.
There is a sense here that international public opinion has had an impact, that it's putting irresistible political pressure on the leaders here and around the world. And while the carnage continues, the calls for it to stop are growing louder.
In the run-up to the demo, an attempt by police to prevent it from finishing in Whitehall, the seat of government. Yet once again, people power prevailed. The UK government has been amongst the most hawkish pro-Israel states in the Western world. And the opposition Labour Party has not acted very differently, with its purge of Israel critics from its ranks. Yet the Palestine Solidarity Movement in Britain has been the largest in Europe.
This is how we are showing those in power how we really feel. And how do we feel? We believe that a genocide is taking place in Palestine and that it is our government and our arms companies that are weaponizing that genocide and are profiteering from it.
A permanent ceasefire is yet to be achieved. But even if there were one tomorrow, organizers say, this movement isn't going away. The shift in public attitudes towards Palestine and its liberation is permanent. Saeed Puriza, London.
Meanwhile, South Koreans have also rallied in the capital, Seoul, to show solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. This is the 20th consecutive protest to call for an end to the U.S.-Israeli genocidal campaign. Frank Smith has been present at the venue of the event and filed this report.
Free Palestine, the slogan heard around the world echoed through the streets of the South Korean capital on Saturday as Israeli slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank goes on unabated. Palestinians in Seoul were also present at the event. Despite the bloodshed of innocent Palestinians, Israel still enjoys the protection of Western powers.
South Korea has abstained from UN votes calling for a ceasefire, although the government has also refrained from fully backing Israel. Seoul does engage in significant arms trade, however, with Tel Aviv. Activists here today, they want that arms trade to stop and for the South Korean government to take a firmer stand against Israel.
The Israeli regime may argue its behavior does not amount to genocide, but since October last year, more than 27,000 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed and almost the entire population of Gaza is displaced. Still, Koreans believe their voices and that of others can make a difference. A global protest is planned for February 17th to show solidarity with Palestinians. Frank Smith, Seoul.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
و سبز و سپید نمانم من نمان منم من ذره خاکه وطنم من ذره خاکه وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کنام شیران ایران همیشه جاویدان.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Islamic Revolution and Revising a Women's Islamic Identity. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. No doubt, the Islamic Revolution has been the most popular movement for several centuries. Without widespread presence of people in all scenes of this great uprising, it was impossible to overthrow a regime which was thoroughly supported by foreign powers, particularly the U.S. regime. Moreover, it enjoyed a very powerful army among the Islamic countries and considered itself as the gendarme of the region. But what made the Islamic Revolution more glorious was the strong and brave participation of women in demonstrations and struggles against the despotic regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In the third episode of this special series, on the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we are going to dwell upon the role of women in the revolution and the revival of their identity as Muslim women in the light of the revolution. Before the Islamic Revolution, women, like men, were suffering from oppression, discrimination, suffocation, and the dire economic conditions. However, it was the spread of immorality and instrumental use of women which had made them angry with the corrupt regime. Yet, Imam Khomeini reminded women of their lost identity and dignity and urged them to create a unique epic among men. The father of the Islamic Revolution marked the role of women in the scenes of the revolution with the words, "We have this victory because of ladies more than men. Our respectful ladies were in the front lines. Our dear ladies caused men to be daring and brave. We are in debt to the efforts of you ladies." This respect, trust, and inducing of identity to Iranian women made a firm bond between them and the Imam and the Islamic Revolution, so much so that they continued their constructive role in the aftermath of the struggles in various fields of defending the achievements of the revolution. The climax of loyalty of the Iranian women toward the ruling system and the country was manifested during the 8-year war that Saddam imposed on the nation at the behest of his masters in Washington and Tel Aviv. They sincerely supported the combatants in the fronts through preparation and sending of food and other necessities for them. Meanwhile, nearly 6,500 women were martyred and thousands of others were injured during the Holy Defense. As the Iranian ladies found their lost identity after the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Revolution also granted them numerous achievements and opportunities. The revival of their Islamic Iranian dignity was the most important among these achievements. Today, the women in Iran, besides fulfilling their role as a mother and wife at home, are responsible humans in the social arena and are active in various domains while keeping their chastity and Islamic code of dressing, which is called hijab. They are no more a tool for meeting the demands of libertine men or companies. Iranian ladies can freely take part in elections as candidates or voters. Now, there are hundreds of ladies in parliament and city councils. Women are also active in 2,700 NGOs, most of which focus on the ladies' problems. The employment of women has significantly increased compared with the pre-revolution era. Presently, More than 45,000 of the employees in the government are women, and 25% of those managerial posts are run by committed and specialized women. Women owe their progresses in social activities mostly to the promotion of their education and relevant skills. Before the Islamic Revolution, around 25% of women were literate, but this figure has reached to nearly 95%. The number of female students and graduates in different academic fields has highly increased. According to the statistics of the Ministry of Sciences, Research and Technology, women form approximately 60% of students and 35% of the scientific board of universities. Since its coming to existence nearly 45 years ago, the Islamic Republic of Iran has taken big strides in promotion of hygiene and health of women, especially in deprived regions of the country. In view of this, the rate of life expectancy has reached to 78 years among women, which is higher than the average global figure. The maternity death toll among pregnant women has decreased to 20 among 100,000 deliveries, which is seen in very few nations. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the Iranian women have made spectacular breakthroughs in sports too. While in the pre-revolution era, women had athletes only in 7 fields, today they are active in over 40 fields of sports and play in 8,000 clubs specialized for ladies. Today, women have gained 3,300 medallions in various international competitions. The important point is that the Iranian female athletes participate in all contests with hijab to show that this Islamic dressing code is no hindrance for social activities. Of course, the Iranian women have made eye-catching progresses after the Islamic Revolution in numerous domains like science, technology, art, culture, and so on. As a matter of fact, women in Iran have rendered great services to the cause of the Islamic Revolution as they find their true identity and esteem after the triumph of the revolution.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us ponder on how to dress in public as expounded to us by the embodiment of dignity, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. He whose dress is chosen by knowledge will have his defects screened from people. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, backbiting versus false accusation. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We all know that backbiting is bad, isn't that right? Backbiting is something discouraged, not just in Islam, even socially, you know, we see that people, they usually do not like backbiters, right? Backbiting is a sin, and a believer must not do backbiting of another believer. But someone may argue that they are not backbiting someone. Instead, they are simply stating the facts and reality. So how can it be a sin? What's wrong with it? You understand the scenario? Some people try to justify their act of backbiting by saying that what I'm saying is a reality. It's not something, you know, that I'm lying and I'm putting on this other believer without any proof. No. So they would be like, if I'm explaining the reality, how in the world is it a sin? How in the world would it be qualified to be backbiting? Well, let's turn to the Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and get the answer. He says, backbiting is speaking about your brother what he does not like to be mentioned. And then he added, know that if you mention what is actually in him, this is backbiting. And if you mention what is not actually in him, this is a false accusation. See the difference between backbiting and false accusation? In the eyes of Islam, in the eyes of Allah, both of them are problematic. But remember, backbiting is a real deficiency that a believer has, and false accusation is making up a story or, you know, blaming something on a believer that he does not carry. Both of them are a sin, and we are not supposed to do that. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of backbiting versus false accusation. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, has said, backbiting is saying about your brother what Allah has hidden for him, but mentioning what is not hidden, for example, a coarse personality or hastiness, which is open characteristics, is not backbiting. However, false accusation is mentioning negative qualities that are not in him. Again, this was the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. The key here is to not reveal a defect of a believer that Allah has hidden for him, right? That said, talking about a personality trait that is obvious and out and open is not considered to be backbiting, technically speaking. While we are at it, there is an akhlaqi and a moral principle that should also be mentioned here. And that is, would you like people to discuss a negative personality trait that you may possess? Well, the answer of most of us is going to be, obviously not. Therefore, we should avoid to discuss the negative aspects of another believer's personality. What we discussed here is not a license to backbite, or it's not a license to highlight the deficiencies of other believers. We're saying that strictly, technically speaking, when it comes to backbiting, it is something that Allah has kept it to be a secret, right? Other than that, if there is a deficiency that a believer may possess and it's out in public, then talking about that
technically is not considered to be backbiting.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Yemen.
Part 5.
Maritime trade and control give superiority in the world. No matter how big a trade on the land is, it won't find a better route for business than the sea. These are the words of Alfred Thayer Mahan, the author of The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, which deals with the importance of sea routes in maritime trade and control over them. About 200 million years ago, all of the lands on the Earth were connected in a supercontinent named Pangaea, but gradually the unified continent started to be divided into different chunks. After tens of millions of years, the map of the Earth looks like what we see today, with several separate continents. Now, the link between the continents on Earth has been established in two ways: through land between Asia, Africa, and Europe, and through the oceans in the Americas, Australia, and Antarctica. Meanwhile, some waterways, natural straits, and artificial canals that were constructed later had a strategic role in shaping the famous maritime corridors today for shipping to access the shortest and most cost-effective routes. Choke points are the links that connect the sea and land. Today, having control over the strategic points gives astonishing powers to countries. Some of the most important waterways in the world are the Malacca, Hormuz, Gibraltar, and Bab el-Mandeb Straits, as well as man-made canals like the Suez and Panama. The Panama Canal was constructed in 1914, so ships in the Atlantic Ocean won't have to turn all the way around South America. The Strait of Gibraltar connects the Mediterranean to the Atlantic Ocean between Spain and Morocco. It's been officially under British control since 1713. The Cape of Good Hope in the southern tip of Africa serves as a link between the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. This is part of the route for the ships that sail from the South Asia to the eastern coast of America. The Bosphorus Strait in Turkey connects the Black Sea to the Sea of Marmara and then the Mediterranean. Besides, the strait facilitates countries like Russia and Ukraine with access to the Mediterranean and high seas. We can argue the Hormuz Strait that joins the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman is now considered the most vital waterway in the world for transit of energy. The Suez Canal in Egypt was constructed in 1869 by France and Britain. Besides its strategic importance, it is used to establish a link between Europe to West Asia and led to flourishing business into other natural straits in the world, namely Bab el-Mandeb and Malacca. The Malacca Strait is located in Southeast Asia between the Indonesian island of Sumatra and the Malay Peninsula. Many experts believe it's the most important maritime choke point in the world. According to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, about 60% of maritime trade passes through Asia. The South China Sea alone carries one-third of the global shipping. The route depends on the Malacca Strait, which connects the South China Sea and the Pacific Ocean to the Indian Ocean. The route is the artery of major economic powers in Asia, like Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and especially China, the second largest economy in the world. Every year, over 100,000 ships in the South China Sea sail towards the Malacca Strait. The Bab el-Mandab Strait, a strait between the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, and joins Asia to the Horn of Africa. The first move by the UAE in its new regional plot was to get Israel involved in the Bab el-Mandab strategic waterway. Israeli officials directly suggested that the UAE develop the Perim Island adjacent to the Bab el-Mandab Strait in order to link it with the Socotra Island in the south of the strait and the Gulf of Aqaba and the port of Eilat in the north of the Red Sea. The development initiated a strategic partnership between the two, the UAE and the Israeli regime. In May 2021, images from the Planet Labs commercial satellite were released from the Perim Island. It showed that there's a relatively large 1,800-meter airstrip under construction on the island. The Israeli website Debka File, affiliated with the Mossad spy agency, for the first time claimed in a report that the UAE was behind the construction on Perim. The Israeli media said the airfield for planes to land and take off, as well as infrastructure for espionage activities on the island, were coordinated between the UAE and Israel to control the ships that sail through Bab el-Mandab towards the Suez Canal, with Iranian commercial ships as the prime targets. What's more, construction of the airport on Perim Island gave the UAE the chance to transfer some of its equipment from the Assab Air Base in Eritrea to this island, which is only 3.5 kilometers away from Yemen's mainland. So in case of aerial backup for its forces, it could be done in the shortest time possible. On the development of Perim Island by the UAE, Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Murphy said that construction of the base on the island reminds us that, as opposed to what the UAE claims, it hasn't gotten out of the Yemen war.
Recent reporting suggests that the administration intends to move forward with the sale of Reaper drones to the UAE. The Emiratis already have a record of illegally transferring weapons to Salafist militias in Yemen, and Congress, frankly, has not received sufficient assurances that such transfers will not happen again.
Some of the main reasons that Saudi Arabia got militarily involved in Yemen were to reduce its reliance on the Strait of Hormuz, have control over Yemen's oil and gas resources, and use potentials of the country's ports near the Red and Arab Seas. The Strait of Hormuz is considered the most strategic route in the world, one-third of the total natural gas products and a sixth of the crude oil in the world pass through the Hormuz Strait. Among the six Arab littoral states of the Persian Gulf, Qatar, Kuwait, and Bahrain can export their oil products only through the Hormuz Strait. A large number of ports in the UAE and Saudi Arabia are dependent on the strategic strait. That's why the two countries have been trying for several decades to find alternative routes and diminish their dependence on the Hormuz Strait.
We're witnessing one of the largest shifts in global geostrategic power that the world is witnessing.
The Saudi government heavily relies on its terminals and ports in places like Ras Al Tanura. According to data released by the U.S. Energy Information Administration, they export 3.4 million barrels of oil produced in Saudi Arabia per day from these ports. During the past decades, Saudi Arabia tried to reduce its dependence on the Persian Gulf terminals and the Strait of Hormuz by expanding its oil pipelines that pass over land called Jubal Yambu, which snakes through the east to the west of the country. The pipeline carries about 3 million barrels of oil every day from refineries from the east of Saudi Arabia, like Abqa and Al-Khurey, to the Yanbu oil terminal in the west on the coast of the Red Sea. But this pipeline alone cannot reduce Saudi Arabia's dependence on the Hormuz Strait. It should have augmented its export capacities. Considering Yemen's location as Saudi Arabia's neighbor and its adjacency to the strategic Bab al-Mandab Strait and the coasts of the Red and Arab Seas, it was the most important option for the Saudis. The UAE is also seeking to develop the Al Fujairah port on the other side of the Hormuz Strait so its commercial ships can directly access the Arab Sea and the Indian Ocean.
Because the Saudis want to be able to, they want to run a pipeline down from Saudi Arabia. I get my pointer for a minute, I'll show you. Because it economically would be very helpful. Right now, all of their oil goes out through the Persian Gulf. Right? And they're worried about, what if that gets shut down at some point? What if the Iranians close down the Strait of Hormuz? So the Saudis up here want to run a pipeline that would come right down through here and go to, right out there, and they'd put up a big facility, and they would bypass the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz and go right through that part. But the Omanis are livid about this. You know, this is basically their backyard, and the Saudis are going to use it for their economic benefit. So I don't know how far that's going to get, but the Saudis are eyeing that little tip of Yemen for economic benefit.
In fact, investment on and construction of a new pipeline from the north to the south, which is complementary to the east-west oil pipeline in Saudi Arabia, namely the Jubal Yanbu pipeline, helped Riyadh to achieve a two-pronged goal. Firstly, it could minimize its dependence on the transit of oil products through the Hormuz Strait. And secondly, it creates the necessary infrastructure to extract the rich and intact oil and gas resources in Yemen and transfers them to southern terminals in the country.
And that's, I mean, the pipeline is still, as far as we know, intact, and it runs down to an Indian Ocean facility, and they can put it on ships and they move it around the world.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Finding clean and safe drinking water in Gaza has become nearly impossible. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Aref Abed 60 lives in Gaza City's Al-Yarmouk neighborhood. Typically, Abed would fill his 1,500-liter barrel with desalinated water from a desalination truck. Yet this is no longer an option. The desalination plants are closed entirely or operating at extremely limited capacity due to a lack of electricity and fuel. The Zionist regime has also destroyed much of Gaza's sanitation and water infrastructure or deliberately cut off the piping in out of water. Abed's options for safe drinking water were non-existent, so he went to a nearby well. Abed knew that such wells do not provide safe drinking water and instead are used for irrigation or other water needs. But he was desperate. When he arrived at the well, he was so thirsty that he drank without thinking. He knew the water was dirty by its taste. Then, when he washed his hands, he saw they were covered in sediments. He said, I saw the water was not pure and had some dirt. I think it is untreated from sewage and unsuitable for using to wash, to clean, or even bathe. He vomited from the water. Still, he forced himself to continue drinking. Then, in mid-January, Abed went to the hospital because he had a high fever and constant diarrhea. He was severely dehydrated. Doctors diagnosed him with typhoid, a life-threatening bacterial infection. If he left untreated, he could experience kidney failure. The vast majority of Palestinians in Gaza do not have adequate access to clean water. Abed was given antibiotics to treat his typhoid, but since he was continuously drinking contaminated water, his condition was not improving. He said, My brother always buys bottled water for me just so I can be healed and for him to avoid the illness. Yet, this is an option that brothers can barely afford. The cost of a small bottle of water, about 500 millimeters worth, now costs nearly $3, which is 10 times its cost before October. Bottled water is not always available in the city, and if it exists, is it sufficient? How will I save my life when there is no clean water in the city? How can I provide water when even UNRWA can't? He asked. Most of the nearly 2 million people who have been displaced in Gaza are now in the south. The lack of clean drinking water is especially acute there. Khan Suleiman 7 is sheltering in an UNRWA school in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Her family was displaced 2 months ago from Gaza City. Cans received bottled water from her parents to drink, but when that was not available, she would drink from the tap at the UNRWA school, she said. I was thirsty to death, she said. Every time I didn't find water in our gallons, I drank from the tap, she said. Earlier this month, Cans came down with a fever and was vomiting and having severe diarrhea for several days. At the school's health center, she was diagnosed with intestinal catarrh. The doctor advised Ken's father to try and provide clean drinking water since the school's tap is polluted. The doctor said that ingesting the water could lead to something more serious like cholera or typhoid. Hamza Suleiman Khan's father said that he asked the doctor, How can I provide clean water for her if UNRWA is unable to provide it for us in the school? The doctor had no response. He instructed Hamza to head to the main UNRWA clinic in Khan Yunis for medications, since the school had run out. Unfortunately, the main clinic, as well as 7 pharmacies Hamza visited, had also run out of medications. Within the week, the entire family, including Hamza's 11-year-old son, Yazan, was sick. Fortunately, a relative had the necessary medication and cans improved after a week of illness, Hamza said. I was grateful for my relative who saved my daughter's life when he gave us the medication. I feared losing her as I couldn't do anything for her. Still accessing clean water is a daily struggle for the people of Gaza. Hamza fills up their water containers at UNRWA when water is available, but it is often not. He said, the desalinated water is not 100% clean like before the war. There is some saltiness to its taste. I think it is half desalinated because of the lack of fuel. Fadia Walid and her 5 children have turned to the sea for water, even though they know it is polluted with sewage. She washes their dishes and cleans their clothes with seawater, and her children bathe in the ocean. They have no other alternative, as the UNRWA school, where they are sheltering, is no longer providing water from the taps. Yet this month, Fadia's son Yasin got sick with a fever and abdominal pain. They went to the hospital and he was diagnosed with hepatitis A. He took medications for 2 weeks and his condition gradually improved. Fadia said, during those 14 days, I was scared to lose him. I stayed all night awake over him to watch his health. I borrowed some bottled water from my neighbors in the school. This clean water helped save his life. The family has stopped using seawater for daily chores after Yasin's illness, but they still don't have regular access to water. Fadia said, if they drink from the sea, they will die. And if they keep thirsty without clean water, they will die as well. So, what's the solution?
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm your host, Saeed Furiza. Before I bring you my panel, let's have a look at some of the latest developments. No let-up in apartheid Israel's attacks. Rescue efforts are ongoing after another night of Israeli bombardments across the Gaza Strip. The relentless shelling has displaced thousands of Palestinian families over the past 3.5 months, but their place of shelter is also turning into a war zone. In the south of the enclave, hospitals are under siege, with medical supplies running low. More than 27,000 Palestinians have now been killed since the beginning of the U.S.-Israeli genocide. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the binding decisions of the International Court of Justice must be complied with. Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh is in Cairo to review a 6-week ceasefire proposal forged in Paris over the weekend ahead of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's return to the region for further talks. Yemen says its naval units have fired several missiles at a U.S. Navy warship in the Red Sea. And Iraqi resistance forces have launched a drone attack on the port city of Haifa in the Israeli-occupied territories. Both those attacks aimed at stopping the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Well, joining me on this edition here in the studio, business owner and analyst Noor Fekri, and via Skype from Essex, organizer and activist